Chapter 7. A public ball was held at the Meryton Assembly Rooms several times a year. Anyone with any pretensions to taste affected to despise these unpretentious entertainments. The rooms were too small, the music too loud, the refreshments scarcely to be borne, but there was never any question of not attending. The first ball of the season was anticipated with the greatest excitement, the more so because, although it always took place in the autumn, the exact date of the event was rarely decided upon until almost the very last moment. As the leaves fell from the trees and the evenings grew darker, expectation mounted, especially amongst the younger people who longed for an opportunity for dancing. But for many weeks, no definite information could be obtained of when it might be held. Inevitably, it was Lydia, on one of her dallying, gossiping trips to the village, who was the first to hear incontrovertible evidence of the day at last being fixed, which she bore back to Longbourn in triumph. Tearing into the hall, with Kitty hurrying in her wake, she ran straight to Mrs. Bennet, eager to impart her good news.
"The ball is to be held on the first Saturday of next month! Oh, I had it from Mr. Thompson himself! I was passing the rooms and there he was, so I asked him, and he told me he had just this minute contracted the musicians, so I am the very first to know."
She perched on a chair, still wearing her hat, desperate to impart all she had discovered.
"The supper is ordered, the rooms are to be swept, and the floor newly sanded to save the dancers' feet. The notice is to go into the paper tomorrow."
Mrs. Bennet, almost as excited as her daughter, clapped her hands.
"Oh, well done, Lydia! How clever of you to have found that out! Did you hear that, Mr. Bennet? The Meryton ball is settled for 3 weeks this Saturday."
"Is it indeed? As I shall not be attending myself, my joy cannot be as unconfined as your own. But I am no enemy to harmless pleasure. Shall you go, Lizzie?"
"I may do," replied Elizabeth. "If Jane will come with me, I'm not yet sure."
Lydia looked at her with frank astonishment.
"Not yet sure? Lizzie, how can you be so annoying? I'm sure I should die if I wasn't there. I should do away with myself from mere frustration."
"You must endeavour to compose yourself, then," said Mr. Bennet calmly, "for I have not yet decided if you are to go. Jane and Lizzie may attend, they have been before, and I have no fears for their good behaviour. Mary, too, may go if she wishes. She is old enough and steady enough to be trusted, but you and Kitty are another matter."
Mary, who sat in the corner with her book on her knees, had never expected her name to be mentioned in the context of a ball. She could not quite believe that her father had praised her. Faint praise, it was true, but she felt herself warm with pride. Meanwhile, Kitty and Lydia set up a great wail of protest.
"You can't mean that, Papa!"
cried Lydia.
"You wouldn't really prevent me from going!" "Really, Mr. Bennet," declared his wife, "I'm sure neither Lydia nor Kitty will do anything to make us ashamed."
"I wish I shared your confidence," he replied. "Neither could possibly be described as discreet or modest, and Lydia is especially headstrong."
Lydia stood up, tears springing into her eyes.
"Papa, you are very unkind. You must let me go. You must."
Mary usually knew better than to tangle with her youngest sister when she'd been denied something she wanted. But, emboldened by her father's approving remark, she ventured to speak in his support. "A young woman's first venture into society cannot be attended with too much care. There are many snares and temptations to overwhelm her if she has not the judgment or experience to resist them." Lydia removed her hat, untying the ribbon deliberately and slowly pulling out the pins.
"Is that so?"
she replied coldly.
"Well, you may be the right age to go into society, but you need not worry about snares and temptations. Just put on those spectacles and you'll be quite safe, I assure you."
With that, she flung down her hat and fled the room, pursued by Kitty and their mother, who said all she could to calm her. Her father was only joking. She knew it was his way. He would change his mind, she was sure of it.
"That's what happens when you poke an angry beehive with a stick," Mr. Bennet observed to Mary dryly. "You must expect to get stung."
Mary rose with as much dignity as she could muster and went upstairs to her bedroom.
There she sat in front of her dressing table and pulled her spectacles out of her pocket. Carefully she placed them on her nose and stared intently at her reflection in the mirror. She turned from side to side, scrutinizing herself from every angle, making no attempt to compose her features into a smile. Her eyes filled with tears. It was just as Lydia said. The dark metal frames looked heavy on her small face, and the lenses gave her an owlish, blinking look. No one could say she was improved by them. She was still seated there when Mrs. Hill knocked at her door some 20 minutes later. She came in with an armful of clean bedclothes, but Mary knew that was not the real reason for her visit.
"I heard what passed between you and Miss Lydia."
Mary, silent, did not look away from the mirror.
"She has a sharp tongue on her when she's thwarted," said Mrs. Hill. "But you know that already."
She put down the bedclothes, pulled up a chair, and sat as close to Mary as she could.
"I hope you won't take it too much to heart," she said in a low voice. "That was anger and willfulness speaking. It doesn't make it true."
"Really?" replied Mary.
"I have been looking at myself this half hour, and I cannot find it in my heart to disagree with her. I cannot, in all honesty, tell you that the spectacles do you many favours," confessed Mrs. Hill. "But you aren't obliged to wear them all the time, and without them you look as well as most women."
Mary turned towards her with a sceptical frown.
"I know you don't believe me, but it's true. Your skin is clear, your figure is decent, neither too thin nor too fat. When you can see them, your eyes are tolerable, and your hair is a pleasant enough light brown, for all it won't take a curl."
"You are very kind, Mrs. Hill, but you don't need to indulge me. The mirror cannot lie."
"Perhaps, but in truth, I don't think you see yourself at all clearly, miss. Your sisters get in the way. A daffodil seems quite ordinary when planted between lilies, but looked at without them, it has its own kind of beauty."
"Yes, I suppose I may be said to be tall, thin, and yellow-looking," Mary smiled bleakly. "But if you're saying I don't bear comparison with my sisters, I have known that for years.
I wonder whether you would be happier if you spent less time with them, if you were to find friends who were remarkable for things other than their looks."
"Lizzie is as much admired for her wit as for her beauty."
"Yes," admitted Mrs. Hill. "She's very lucky to be both clever and handsome. But I think if you went into the world a little more, you would see how very unusual it is to be blessed as she has been. Most people are far more ordinary, you know, as you would discover if you met some new company and went out now and again."
"I don't think I have much inclination for either. I have my piano and my books."
"I'm not sure that's enough for a girl of your age. Come now, what about the Meryton Ball? I hope you'll be going along to it. If Miss Lydia is to go, I can't see why you should not."
"Our father has not yet pronounced upon that question," began Mary. But Mrs. Hill's expression suggested she thought Mr. Bennet's objections would not long withstand the determined assault mounted against them by his youngest daughter and his wife.
"I haven't made up my mind either," she continued. "I'm not sure I should enjoy it." "Why ever not? It may not be the grandest affair, but there'll be music and dancing and lots of laughter and high spirits. You've never been to a ball. Wouldn't you like to see what one's like?"
"I don't know. I should have to consider it."
"You could have a new dress if you could decide quickly. I could come with you to pick out a nice muslin. We could get it made up in a pretty style, nothing too bright or gaudy. I could do your hair for you too, not as your mother likes it, but in a way that might suit your taste. What do you say?"
"I don't know. I should be afraid. What if no one danced with me?"
"Then you'll eat lots of ices and laugh at them for their silliness. Why don't you think about it overnight? It's a hard thing to see a girl as young as you set her face against pleasure and good fellowship. There'll be time enough for that in the future, believe me."
When Mrs. Hill had gone, Mary lay on her bed looking at the ceiling and brooding on what she had heard. Mrs. Hill's enthusiasm had piqued her curiosity, and she began to question her resolution not to attend the dance. Perhaps she was wrong to stay at home. It might be exciting to go out into the cold autumnal darkness, squeezed into the hired carriage with her sisters, bumping along the road to Meryton. She had never seen the assembly rooms at night, lit up and garlanded with paper flowers and the first of the winter holly. She thought she might like to hear the orchestra scrape out the old familiar airs and jigs and watch people enjoying themselves. Really, why should she not go? It was only a country dance. Other girls of her age had been and lived to tell the tale, and not all of them were beauties. And was it not said, although she could not at this precise moment recollect by whom, that, to the thinking mind, no experience was wasted? In half an hour, she had almost persuaded herself it was her duty to attend, and if she did go, then surely she was obliged to have a dress suitable for the occasion. If one went into society, it was only proper to abide by its rules. For the first time she could remember, she allowed her imagination to run away with thoughts of beautiful fabrics and elegant clothes, of colours, styles, and trimmings. Just before she fell asleep, she finally concluded that Mrs. Hill was quite right. It made no sense to deny herself this opportunity. For once, she would see a little of life, and moreover, she would make an effort to present herself as neatly, as smartly, and as becomingly as she could. She would go to the dance and have a new dress for it too. For once, she would try to enjoy herself as she had seen others do. At breakfast the next day, it was clear to everyone that Mr. Bennet had delivered his judgment, and Lydia's triumphant bearing made it plain that he had decided in her favour. She could barely contain her excitement, which interrupted but did not entirely prevent her rapid consumption of hot rolls and butter.
"Thank you, Papa! Thank you, thank you! I swear I shall love you forever now!"
Mrs. Bennet, entirely satisfied, smiled broadly at her favourite daughter, but her husband looked grave. "Your gratitude gives me more pause for thought than your petulance ever did. I am not at all sure I was wise to give in to you." Mr. Bennet was a man of considerable natural perception, and there were few situations in which he did not understand what was required of him. But exertion bored him, and he could rarely be bothered to act, even upon what he knew to be right. He found it far easier to mock his daughters than to take the trouble to correct them. Only for Lizzie did he feel any real respect, which was perhaps why she alone felt able to challenge him.
"Then, Papa, why do you do so?" she asked. "A little firmness on this occasion might impress upon Lydia that not everything is to be had by making a fuss."
"Really, Lizzie," cried Mrs. Bennet, "you sound just like Mary. And what, pray, has it to do with you anyway? I shall be there to look after Lydia and Kitty and make sure they behave exactly as they should."
Mr. Bennet laid down his knife and regarded the table with bitter satisfaction. "You see, my dears, there is no need for concern. Your mother, with her usual decorum, will ensure that neither silliness nor self-indulgence will prevail." Mary saw Elizabeth catch Jane's eye and watched a glance pass between them, of anxiety, regret, pain, a whole host of emotions in one brief look. Her younger sisters were oblivious. Lydia had quite recovered her usual confidence and was blithely helping herself to more tea and more jam.
"Kitty must come as well," demanded Lydia. "If I am to go, it would be monstrously unfair if she did not."
Kitty nodded furiously, her mouth full of roll. But before she could utter a plea in support of her case, Mary decided to make her own announcement. "I think I should like to go too, Papa, if there is no objection to my doing so."
"You want to go?"
exclaimed Lydia, genuinely surprised.
"Whatever for?"
"I think it's time I saw something of the world." Mary had resolved to say no more than this. She had no intention of being teased by Lydia into offering a fuller explanation of her decision. Nothing on earth would have forced her to admit that she had actually begun to look forward to the ball.
"Of course you may go," replied Mr. Bennet testily. "Everyone may go who wishes to go, providing I am obliged to hear no more about it. But, Mrs. Bennet, you are to understand there is no point in applying to me for funds to buy new outfits. I will underwrite a few fripperies, ribbons and feathers, I suppose, but that is the limit of my generosity. There will be no incontinent purchasing of gowns, shawls, shoes, and the like."
Lydia, Kitty, and their mother were equally distraught to hear this, but Mr. Bennet was implacable.
No, no, not another word. I have already been persuaded once to act against my inclination. On this subject, I am immovable.
I have some little money saved, said Mary thoughtfully. I never spend my allowance, so I think I shall have enough for a dress, if it can be made in time. Lydia glared from across the table.
Lord, you really are the most annoying prig.
That may be true, said Mary, quite calm now, but at least I shall have the satisfaction of being a prig in a new dress. Later that morning, Mary and Mrs. Hill walked into the draper's shop at Meryton, and there they found a figured muslin of the palest cream. White would be too harsh for Mary's complexion, insisted Mrs. Hill, shot through with a faint gold thread. Mary thought it the most beautiful stuff she had ever seen, fingering its delicate weave with a respectful touch. Once wrapped up, she refused to hand over the bulky parcel to Mrs. Hill, but carried it home herself, both proud and a little fearful that she had taken such a huge step. In her bedroom, she discussed with Mrs. Hill how it was to be made up. It was impossible to ask advice from her sisters. With Jane or Elizabeth, she would have been too self-conscious, and it was far too late to attempt such a conversation with Kitty or Lydia. They would have laughed at her uncertain attempts to find a style that suited her. Besides, her taste did not run towards the flounces and ruffles that delighted Lydia. On her, they would look false and wrong. She would be most at ease in a simple dress that did not announce itself too loudly. Perhaps, she thought, a plain dress was the best ornament for a plain woman. In 10 days, it was ready. The dressmaker brought it at dusk, delivering it, as she had been asked, directly into Mrs. Hill's hands. Mary had no wish for her sisters to see the gown before she did. Hurrying up the stairs to her room, with Mrs. Hill following in her wake, she was breathless with excitement. Once inside, she lit a candle whilst Mrs. Hill locked the door. Her hands fumbled with the string of the parcel, but she soon had it open. When she held up the dress, it tumbled over her arms, the gold thread catching the gleam from the candlelight. It was as airy and delicate as a cloud, utterly unlike the well-scrubbed grey and beige cottons which she usually wore. Yes, it was plain, with no decoration to distract the eye, but there was a purity in its plainness, an elegance in its simplicity.
"It has turned out very well," said Mrs. Hill. "Very well indeed."
Mary held the dress up in front of herself and peered into her mirror.
"Is it too fine for me, do you think? Shall I look ridiculous?"
"No, you will not. I believe you'll look very handsome in it."
Mary looked shyly at her reflection. She would not go as far as handsome, but she thought she would not stand out as awkward or strange, and that was enough for her. Chapter 8. On the night of the ball, Mrs. Hill was in great demand, hurrying from room to room, helping each of the sisters with the final adjustments to her dress, pinning and tucking, snipping and trimming. But it was Mary to whom she devoted most of her time, arranging her hair in a style as smooth and simple as her dress, with no attempt at imposing short-lived curls. When she had finished, she drew a twist of paper from her apron pocket, undid it carefully, and placed it on the dressing table, revealing a small pinch of pale pink powder.
"Is that rouge?" asked Mary uncertainly.
"It is indeed, borrowed from Miss Lydia's drawer. She has enough of it not to notice the loss of such a little amount."
"You're not suggesting I should wear it, are you?"
"Only the very smallest touch. That's all you need. Put your finger into it as lightly as you can and rub it very gently into your cheek."
Mary took the little package and stared into it curiously.
"Go on," insisted Mrs. Hill. "The very tiniest quantity. No one will know, I promise you."
Her mind suddenly made up, Mary dabbed her finger into the powder as delicately as she could and applied it to her face.
"Just a little at first," advised Mrs. Hill. "It's a bit like cooking. You can always add more salt, but you can't take it out. There. That's perfect. You have a bit of colour, but you don't look painted. Time to put the gown on now, if you're not to be late.
The dress slid over Mary's head with a confident, slippery ease, and suddenly there she was, ready. She was almost afraid to look at herself, but plucked up the courage to stare at her reflection in the pier glass. She saw a tall young woman with a neat figure, sleek brown hair, and mild, regular features, clad in a light and pretty dress. Relief flooded over her. She knew she would never turn heads when she walked into a room, as she had so often seen her sisters do, but as she surveyed herself with her usual critical eye, she thought she looked as well as she had ever done. She would do.
"Very pleasing," said Mrs. Hill. "Just what we'd hoped for. There's still one thing left to do."
With that, she reached across Mary's face, took off her spectacles, and laid them on the dressing table.
"Now you're ready, and Miss Lydia's been calling this last 10 minutes.
Left alone in her room, Mary looked at her discarded spectacles, uncertain what to do. Then, after a moment's hesitation, she picked them up, stuffed them into her little evening bag, and made her way downstairs to meet her sisters. Unusually for her, Mary was the last to come down, and when she arrived in the hall, everyone was already there, waiting and chatting. Her appearance silenced them all, as they took her in. Elizabeth spoke first, looking her up and down with appreciative surprise.
"That is a very handsome dress. You look very well in it, Mary."
"Indeed you do," agreed Jane. "The colour is just right. It suits you perfectly."
Mrs. Bennet drew herself away from the hallway mirror, where she had been making all those vital last-minute adjustments to her outfit and person, without which she would not have considered leaving the house. She examined Mary coolly. She had long hoped to see an improvement in Mary's appearance, but, as she had had no hand in her transformation, she was not inclined to be generous.
"So, miss, it seems you can make an effort when you choose. What a pity you can't be troubled to do so more often."
"It's amazing what new clothes will do,"
observed Lydia tartly.
"Anyone is improved by them. If I had a new dress to wear, I'm sure I should astonish you all."
"I have no doubt you will do that," remarked Elizabeth, "new dress or not." Mary drew her cloak carefully over herself, pleased that her outfit had provoked nothing worse than she had expected, and followed her sisters out into the cold night air. She was silent as their coach pulled away from the house, and no one spoke to her. Jane and Elizabeth chatted in low whispers, whilst Lydia addressed them all in loud declarations which did not require a reply.
"Just think, Mama, I saw Dick Smithson in Meryton yesterday, and he positively insisted I should keep the second dance for him. He's engaged to that annoying Miss Denny for the first, but she's his cousin, so I suppose he was obliged. And Captain Carter has bespoke me for the third. I do hope he'll wear his regimentals. You can't believe how much he's improved by them."
"Oh, but I can," answered Mrs. Bennet. "I liked an officer well enough myself once. I hope for your sake he will wear them tonight."
"And for the fourth,"
Lydia continued, having hardly noticed her mother's intervention,
"I am in hopes of William Digby. I told him he would have to find ices for me afterwards, for I am sure to be sweating all over by then."
Elizabeth raised her eyes in exasperation as Kitty gave way to a wail of outrage.
"Lydia, you know Mr. Digby asked me for the fourth dance. You are not to steal him away. Really, Mama, tell her she mustn't. It isn't fair."
Huddled in the corner, Mary began to consider her own chances of finding a partner. She knew so few young men. Lydia's and Kitty's daily walks into Meryton had introduced them to numerous masculine acquaintances, especially since the arrival some months ago of a militia regiment. They met officers sauntering about the streets, bantered with them outside the milliner's shop, and counted many among them as their intimate friends. Jane and Elizabeth were more aloof, but even they had been sometimes known to acknowledge the salutes of the more gentlemanly of the soldiers with a polite inclination of their heads. Mary had no such small introductions to smooth over her way into the ballroom. She rarely accompanied her sisters on their trips into Meryton, and when she did, she had nothing to say to any officer whose path they happened to cross. She had no talent for charming small talk or provoking chit-chat. As the carriage rolled into Meryton, her anxiety grew. All the excitement she had felt when she left the house began to drain away as she thought about what lay ahead. Whilst the ball had remained safely in the future, she had been able to think of it almost with excitement. But now it was about to become a reality, it felt very different. As they pulled up before the assembly rooms, her courage began to fail her. What would she do if no one asked her to dance? She had heard Jane and Lizzie laughingly lament occasions when they had found themselves with no one to stand up with, but they did so with the cheerful self-mockery of those for whom this was a rare event. They could be sure they would not linger like that for long. Another partner would inevitably appear at any moment. Mary knew she could summon up neither their poise nor their confidence. As the Longbourn party gathered their cloaks and bags, eager to be out of the carriage, Mary followed her mother and sisters towards the light and noise of the ball, her heart in her mouth. Chapter 9. The crowd of people gathered at the entrance to the rooms seemed immense, as forbidding and impenetrable as she had feared. Mary was buffeted from side to side, almost deafened by the shouted greetings that echoed over her head as she struggled to make her way through the knots of excited guests huddled in the hallway. Desperate not to lose sight of her sisters, whose progress through the scrum was, she noted, followed by a number of appreciative male gazes, she pushed onwards with all the courage she could muster until, at last, she emerged into the open space of the ballroom. For a moment, she stood quite still, amazed at what she saw. The old rooms, as she knew them, were unrecognisable. There were candles everywhere, not, it was true, of the most expensive kind, and a distinct smell of tallow hung in the air. But the flickering light they cast transformed the scuffed walls and lit up the boughs of autumn leaves hung upon them as decoration. In the distance, through a pair of double doors, she could see the inn servants laying out the supper table, the footmen polishing the serving spoons on their aprons. Upstairs, perched on the balcony, the musicians were tuning their instruments and drinking a last glass of beer before beginning their work. On the floor itself, impatient couples had already begun to gather, pacing up and down, keen for the dancing to begin. Kitty and Lydia were quickly swallowed by the throng. Mary looked about but could see no one she knew. For a moment she considered putting on her glasses. She scrabbled in her little bag, and her fingers clasped around them, but then she imagined Lydia's expression if she were to see her wearing them, triumphant, as if the sight of Mary's spectacles more than compensated for the insult of her new dress. Mary hastily withdrew her hand from her bag, and was just beginning to panic when she felt Elizabeth's touch on her shoulder.
"Over here, Mary. We found a place to sit where we shall be quite comfortable."
Lizzie led her deftly through the press of people towards a row of chairs, arranged so that their occupants could comfortably survey the dancing without being obliged to join in themselves. Their mother had already found a place there, alongside Lady Lucas, her particular friend. They spent much of their time together, for each found in the other exactly what they sought in a companion. Mrs. Bennet required an acolyte, and Lady Lucas, timid and deferential, was happy to play the role of obedient disciple. Only once had the natural order of their intimacy been disturbed. When Mr. Lucas, a wealthy Meryton merchant, had been honoured with a baronetcy, it seemed as though all must change, for how could a mere Mrs. Bennet continue to patronise the newly minted Lady Lucas? But to her immense relief, Mrs. Bennet soon discovered that her friend's title had done nothing to alter her docile temper, and that she was as prepared as ever to submit without complaint to the condescension that was an inescapable ingredient of Mrs. Bennet's fond and unalterable regard. Behind Lady Lucas's chair stood Charlotte, her eldest daughter. She was an open-faced young woman of medium height with no great claims to beauty. Her unremarkable appearance was a source of great satisfaction to Mrs. Bennet, who frequently drew to Lady Lucas's attention the contrast between Charlotte's scanty attractions and those of her own daughters. Nor did she hesitate to dwell, with all the sympathy at her command, upon the disappointment her friend must feel at Charlotte's still remaining unmarried at the age of 26, especially as there seemed so little chance of her changing her situation. Lady Lucas was too faint-hearted to contradict Mrs. Bennet, nodding resignedly on such occasions, but her pliant nature was not without benefits for her otherwise unfortunate child. Lady Lucas was too mild-mannered to summon up the angry petulance which came so readily to Mrs. Bennet, and Charlotte had been subjected to none of the recrimination and complaint which had been Mary's lot. Perhaps for that reason, Charlotte did not hang her head, ashamed at her failure to become a beauty, but greeted the world with a clear-eyed, watchful gaze. She had no illusions about her looks, but her bearing suggested she had no intention of apologising for them. Instead, she acknowledged her situation with a wry amusement, and those who did not know her well were often surprised by the acuteness of her perceptions and the sharpness of her wit. These were the qualities that had recommended her strongly to Elizabeth, who had for some years counted her as her closest friend. It was towards Charlotte's welcoming presence that Lizzie now steered Mary, before seizing for herself the last remaining empty seat.
What a rout! I swear the crowd gets bigger every season. Soon we'll have to take turns on the dance floor. The managers will issue everyone with a number and call us out couple by couple.
Or perhaps, replied Charlotte, they could limit admittance only to those young ladies fortunate enough to have secured partners for more than half the dances. The rest of us could be left in the hall, like so much unwanted baggage, to be called for when required.
Oh, declared Elizabeth, I won't listen to that kind of talk. I don't believe you have no partners. And if you don't, it's because you greet everyone with such a baleful stare that no man would dare approach you.
You're quite right, agreed Charlotte. I have partners aplenty lined up for me, two cousins home from school just old enough to be here, and an ancient friend of my father's who will squire me onto the floor with the greatest courtesy, all the time wondering with ill-disguised anxiety when supper will be served.
Elizabeth reached out and took Charlotte by the hand.
I think you've been sitting far too long amongst the matrons. That's enough to dampen anyone's spirits. Now you've put the thought of eating into my head, I can't dislodge it. Shall we go and look at the food and see if we can persuade them to give us a little something in advance of the crowd? Mary, why don't you stay here? We shan't be long, and we might even bring back a morsel or two for you.
Mary watched as her sister carried her friend away, their arms entwined, heads bent towards each other, sharing a joke. Her courage had been shaken even further by Charlotte's words. If she could not secure proper partners, what hope was there for Mary? Just at that moment, the little orchestra finally struck up, and with a thunder of feet, the dancers rushed onto the floor. The noise was quite extraordinary. The music, the laughter, the acclamations, and for an instant, Mary could barely hear herself think. Couples marched, strolled, and trotted up and down the line, some with more enthusiasm than skill, but all with the greatest determination to enjoy themselves. In their midst, Mary soon spotted Lydia, flushed, loud, excited, arm in arm with an officer whose regimentals were all she could have desired. Mary felt a sudden pang. Why could she not be there too, lost in the shared delight of it all? Instead, she stood amongst the seated circles of mothers, aunts, married sisters, whose dancing days were over. At first, she had thought them a cheerful, companionable group, happy to watch the proceedings and chat amongst themselves, but as a second dance began and she remained unclaimed, she thought she felt their eyes directed towards her. She was sure they were discussing her, some with pity, some with scorn. She imagined them weighing up the likelihood of anyone presenting himself to ask her, and deciding the odds were low. Where were Lizzie and Charlotte? Were they never coming back? Mary looked about her with mounting unease. Her mother, she was thankful to see, was engrossed in conversation with Lady Lucas, and seemed not yet to have noticed her lonely state. But she doubted this could continue for very long. She knew Mrs. Bennet would not be pleased to see a daughter of hers so shamefully circumstanced. Growing increasingly self-conscious, she did all she could to seem unconcerned, to convey a nonchalance she was very far from feeling. Then, just as the music struck up for the next dance, a hand was extended to her.
I would be grateful, miss, to have the pleasure of dancing with you.
She looked up, surprised. She did not recognize either the voice or the face of her rescuer.
I am William Lucas, Miss Mary, cousin of Miss Charlotte, your sister's friend.
So this was one of the youthful relations whom even Charlotte had not considered a creditable partner. It was true he was young, perhaps not even 16, but that was not so far off her own age. Why should she not accept him? She smiled at him with genuine gratitude and allowed herself to be led onto the floor. Neither Mary nor her partner embarrassed themselves. They did not trip or stumble over the other's feet. He asked her if she was enjoying her evening. She said that she was, and there the conversation closed. At the dance's conclusion, he led her back to her place, bowed politely, and moved away. It was an entirely unexceptional encounter. It was unlikely he would ask her again, and yet Mary's spirits leapt. A man, or, as honesty compelled her to admit, a boy, had danced with her. To be asked was all she had wished for. She should not have to go home from her first ball and say no one had chosen her. She almost hugged herself as she looked around for Lizzie and Charlotte. She could see no sign of Charlotte, but thought she could just make out Elizabeth's familiar form on the other side of the room, talking with her usual animation to an attentive young man. Was it her or not? Mary narrowed her eyes and peered into the distance. So intent was she in looking for her sister that she did not hear the quiet voice at her side the first time it addressed her. "Excuse me, Miss Mary, I do not mean to intrude, but it is very bad for your eyes to screw them up in that way." She turned to find a young man standing before her, respectful but concerned, clearly dressed in his newest and smartest clothes. At first she did not know him. "Perhaps I may be permitted to help you find whatever or whomever you are looking for."
"Mr. Sparrow? Mr. John Sparrow?"
He bowed and looked down, a little self-conscious.
"Please excuse me, Miss Bennet. I should not have presumed, but I did not want you to strain your eyes. I should not have spoken."
"No, Mr. Sparrow, I'm very grateful to you. After all, you know better than anyone what my difficulties are. May I take advantage of you, sir? I'm looking for my sister Elizabeth. I thought I saw her towards that corner. Am I mistaken?"
No, miss, you're quite right. She was talking to a gentleman with whom she's just stood up."
He pointed towards the set of dancers readying themselves to begin. "I believe it is Captain Carter, of the Hearts Militia." That would not please Lydia, thought Mary to herself, and the ghost of a smile crossed her face. This seemed to encourage Mr. Sparrow, who shifted somewhat nervously in his place before speaking again.
I wonder, Miss Mary, if you would do me the honour of standing up with me for the next dance?"
For the very briefest of moments, Mary hesitated. Then, impelled by the surprising rush of pleasure his invitation had provoked, she accepted.
"I should be delighted to do so, Mr. Sparrow."
He smiled back, relieved.
"Well, then, I thank you. That is to say, I'm very grateful, very much so. Shall we remain here until the next set is called?"
Whilst they waited together at the edge of the dance floor, he asked how her spectacles had answered. Had they made it easier for her to read and to sew?
"To tell the truth, Mr. Sparrow, I'm no great hand with a needle, with spectacles or without, but I can't thank you and your father enough for the improvement they have brought about in my reading. I can study for hours now, and even the smallest print holds no terrors for me."
He was delighted to hear it. Might she tell him what she read with such enjoyment? Mary looked at him warily. Was he teasing her? But his sincere expression convinced her he really wished to know, and soon she found herself telling him all about Mrs. Macaulay. He nodded thoughtfully. His own preference, he explained, was for works of science, but on her recommendation he should seek out that lady's works and do his best to appreciate them.
"Are you a scholar then, sir?"
He looked embarrassed. "Not yet," he admitted. "But I very much hope to become one. My interest is in optics and the mechanics of the eye. I suppose you might say that the apple has not fallen far from the tree in that respect."
"But that's an admirable thing," replied Mary. "It is only natural you should wish to increase your knowledge of a subject already familiar to you."
"I'm very glad you think so." He leant a little towards her and continued in a low, confidential tone. "My father has it in mind to send me to study medicine. He says I have it within me to become a doctor."
"You'll go to the university, then?"
No, my father says the best place for me is one of the London medical schools. He thinks Bart's Hospital, or maybe Moorfields. Both are counted the very best in their field. For a moment, all his diffidence melted away. His face lit up with excitement at the thought of such a future. Then, just as suddenly, he remembered himself. But it's not a thing generally known. I have not mentioned it before to anyone but you.
It is a noble ambition, sir. I honour you for it, and I shall speak of it to no one else.
Then the music struck up. Mr. Sparrow held out his hand, and they made their way onto the floor. This time, she enjoyed every moment of the dance. The music was exhilarating. The push and pull of the other dancers as they changed partners and handed each other down the line made her feel joyfully connected, as though she was at the centre of an excited, happy band of friends. For once she was part of the pleasure, not watching it from afar. When reunited with Mr. Sparrow, they both beamed at each other, delighted to be together again. When the music stopped, she was more sorry than she could say that the dance was over.
"Thank you, Mr. Sparrow," she exclaimed as he showed her to a chair. "I liked that of all things."
"So did I, so did I. It was the best dance I've had in a very long time. I suppose I could not persuade you to stand up with me again, if you are free?"
This time, Mary did not hesitate.
"I have no engagement for the next dance, sir, and would be delighted to be your partner again."
Chapter 10. Neither Mary nor Mr. Sparrow spoke very much whilst they waited for the next dance. They sat quietly, recovering their breath until the set was called and the dancers lined up again. This time, Lydia was nearby, a few couples behind in the line, victoriously handed onto the floor by Captain Carter. Her face registered astonishment as she saw Mary take her place. She turned her head as far as she could to see who her partner might be, and shot her sister a questioning stare. But Mary made no response and allowed herself again to be carried away by the music and movement. When the dance finished, Lydia looked as though she might walk over and begin an interrogation directly. But Mary was relieved to see another officer approach her, and she was soon too distracted to tear herself away.
"Should you like a cold drink now, Miss Bennet? I would be glad to go and find one for you."
Mary thought this an excellent idea, and watched as Mr. Sparrow marched quickly away to the supper room. She could not remember when she had last been so happy. A man had danced with her, not once, but twice. She had never imagined such a thing might happen to her. She looked down at the floor to hide the pleasure she felt she could hold within herself no longer. And for that reason, she did not see Charlotte Lucas approaching her until she was almost at her side.
"It looks as though you're enjoying yourself, Mary."
"Why, Charlotte, you came upon me very quietly."
"Yes, I am indeed. The evening has been very kind to me so far."
"You have been dancing a great deal. Your partner is the young Sparrow boy, I believe."
"Yes, he's been very attentive."
"You have stood up with him twice, and he has gone to find refreshments for you, I imagine?"
She nodded again, a little puzzled by Charlotte's tone.
"Mary, you are very young and do not perhaps fully appreciate how these things are understood. If you dance with him again, it will be remarked upon. Two dances in succession suggests a liking. Three might imply something more."
"Well, he hasn't asked me to dance again."
"Oh, but I think he will, if he's taken the trouble to find you a drink. That shows great consideration on his part. It is a positive battleground in the supper room."
Although she knew she should not do so, Mary smiled again. Charlotte looked at her gravely.
"If he does, I would advise you most strongly to refuse him. Say you are tired or too much heated, that you intend to dance no more for a while."
"But he's been so kind to me, and I have loved dancing with him."
Charlotte regarded her with a faintly pitying look.
"I'm afraid I shall have to speak more plainly. No matter how kind he is not a suitable partner for you. His father visits people's houses and fits them for spectacles. Think what Mr. Bennet would say." Overcome with shame,
Mary could not at first compose herself to reply. "My father barely notices if I'm in the room or not," she thought. "He hardly speaks to me. Why should he care if I have some conversation with a polite, respectable young man?" "For myself," said Charlotte, staring calmly out at the dance floor, "I do not mind at all. I am arrived at a time when I think I might look kindly on the man who runs the circulating library, if he were to speak nicely to me and offer to keep new books aside on my behalf. For all he is over 50 and blind in one eye, but," she declared, turning to look at Mary directly, "I am not your mother, and I can promise you that if I have noticed those two dances and the refreshments Mr. Sparrow expects to share with you, she will have done so too." She touched Mary's shoulder very lightly with her fan. "I mention it only as a friend who understands better than most in your family how rare and how pleasing it is for women like us to be singled out in this way. But whatever his charms, I'm afraid you will find your mother has an altogether different sense of his worth." With that, she tipped her head in polite acknowledgement and moved away. Astonished, Mary stood rooted to the spot. "Charlotte is jealous," she told herself. "No one wants to dance with her. Because she is miserable, she cannot bear that anyone else should be happy. She seeks to spoil for others what she cannot have for herself." But much as she tried to resist them, disturbing thoughts began to take shape in her mind. It was only too easy to imagine how Mrs. Bennet would respond to the idea of her dancing with Mr. Sparrow. She pictured her mother rising up from her little gold chair, marching across the floor, declaring to a horrified Mr. Sparrow that her daughter would not be standing up with him in the next set, nor in any other. She saw him humbled and humiliated as Mrs. Bennet carried her away, saw him standing solitary and ashamed in their wake. She understood in an instant that this would happen. How could she have been so stupid? Lydia had seen her. She would make sure their mother knew, would laugh and crow and joke about it. She swallowed hard. She could not allow it. She could not watch whilst such a good man was made to look a fool, only for paying her some small attentions. By the time she caught sight of Mr. Sparrow's tall figure striding back to her with two glasses in his hand, she knew what she had to do. "I'm sorry to have been so long away, but the crowd fighting for its supper was immense. I never knew Meryton was home to so many hungry people." "Thank you, sir," said Mary, taking her drink, unable to meet his smile. "It is most welcome, for I am very thirsty." She looked away, and from the corner of her eye she caught an unwelcome glimpse of her mother and Lady Lucas, still seated in their sanctuary with their heads close together in talk. Were they staring in her direction as they did so? Mary could not tell. Her stomach lurched with fear. She peered into the flickering candlelight, but could not make out their faces. "Shall we stand up once more?" John Sparrow extended his hand with the clear expectation she would accept. "Thank you, sir, but I cannot. That is, I'm afraid I must decline." He paused and lowered his arm. "But why not? I thought... She could not bear to see his expression, confused and disappointed. I know, and so did I. But my mother, I fear..." At last she got possession of herself enough to speak sensibly. "I am very sorry, but I cannot dance with you again. I have very much enjoyed it. Really I have, but cannot do so any more. I am persuaded I have danced enough for one night. I am sorry, but now I must take my leave." She handed her drink back to him, and he stood there, two glasses in hand, as she walked blindly towards where Mrs. Bennet and Lady Lucas sat. A few hot tears sprang into her eyes, but she wiped them away harshly. No one, and least of all her mother, should see she was upset. When she arrived at Mrs. Bennet's side, Mary saw immediately that she was extremely displeased.
"Where have you been?" she demanded as Mary approached. "I haven't seen you these 2 hours. Lydia told me you have been dancing with the oculist's son, with the boy who made your glasses. I said it couldn't be true, that even you, Mary, would have more consideration than to subject me to such an embarrassment. His father keeps a shop, you know, with a bell on the door."
Mary thought it best to say nothing. An argument would only draw attention to her shame. Instead, she took up a position behind her mother, where she could not be seen by the revellers. She hung her head and smoothed her cream and gold dress. She would not dance again, no matter who asked her. The time dragged heavily after that. Occasionally, her sisters returned to speak to their mother or to dab scent behind their ears. Only Elizabeth noticed Mary's sad, extinguished presence.
"Are you quite well, Mary? I saw you standing up earlier. You looked in fine spirits. Has something happened?"
"No, Lizzie, nothing at all. I am content where I am."
"You do not look content. I'm going back for a last jog about. Won't you come with me?"
"Thank you, but no. I shan't dance again." At last, when all the food was eaten and all the decent wine drunk, the ball drew to a close. The musicians played God Save the King, and the servants began snuffing out the candles. Mary followed her sisters into the hall, where the guests rummaged furiously through a mountain of cloaks and coats. At the front of the scrum, Kitty was bravely plucking out any garment she recognised.
"Mary, are you there? Here's your cloak!"
She threw it over the heads of those behind her, but Mary was too slow to catch it. Another arm reached out and rescued it. As she looked up, Mary saw it was John Sparrow. He handed it to her wordlessly. She accepted it in equal silence. Then he nodded at her blankly and was gone. Chapter 11. In the carriage going home, Lydia was in the highest possible spirits. She had been forced to sit out only two dances the whole evening and had made the acquaintance of three new officers, hitherto unthought of. She regaled her sisters with a detailed account of her successes, but they were not a very receptive audience. Jane and Kitty were both soon asleep. Elizabeth gazed out the window, and Mary played with her gloves, plaiting the fingers together and then untwisting them again, her mind far away. Finally, piqued beyond endurance by the lack of interest in her conquests, Lydia looked about her, searching for a suitable subject to tease and annoy.
"And what about you, Mary? I saw you standing up with two beaux, though it must be said one was a schoolboy and the other a shopkeeper. What a triumph for your first outing."
Mary threw her gloves into her lap, as angered as her sister had hoped she would be.
"At least they were both gentlemen, which is more than can be said for some of the partners you were so desperate to be seen with."
Lydia, who much preferred an argument to silence, laughed out loud.
"You don't really mean to say that Mr. Sparrow is a gentleman. Even you can't really believe that. His father has a shop in Hartford. I suppose we may look forward to seeing you serving there, wearing a green apron in daytime and drawing up the accounts by night."
"You seem to have forgotten," retorted Mary, "that our grandfather had an office in Meryton, and our uncle keeps one there still. Are they not to be considered gentlemen?"
"Really, Mary, for shame," cried Mrs. Bennet. "Your grandfather was an attorney, as is your uncle. That is a profession, not a trade."
"But what of my Uncle Gardiner? He is a merchant, is he not?" countered Mary, as furious now as her mother.
"He has his own warehouses," exclaimed Mrs. Bennet, "and a large house at Gracechurch Street. There is every difference in the world." "Anyway," concluded Lydia, happy now that everyone was cross, "if I ever find myself in want of spectacles, which I devoutly hope will never be the case, I shall be sure to obtain them from your little business. I hope that for such a near relation you will offer a decent discount."
Mrs. Bennet, still smarting from the insults she believed had been offered to her family, tossed her head in disdain. Nothing mattered more to her than seeing her daughters safely married. But it was inconceivable that one of her girls should unite herself to a man who had sent in his bill for Mr. Bennet to pay.
"I only danced with him twice," said Mary, in a small, defeated voice.
"That is twice more than I should have permitted if I had seen you do so,"
declared Mrs. Bennet.
"I want to hear no more of this, Sparrow. In truth, I'm surprised at his presumption."
Mary said no more. When the carriage arrived back at Longbourn, she hurried up to her room and closed the door. She did not answer Mrs. Hill's knocks. For a while, she stared dry-eyed into the darkness. Then she lit a candle and undressed herself. She folded the new dress over a chair, where, until she blew out the flame, Its gold threads continued to catch the flickering brightness from the candle. Chapter 12. Mary avoided all Mrs. Hill's attempts to discover how she had enjoyed the ball. She hid in her bedroom, pleading a headache, or retreated to the garden, walking alone amongst the shrubs. What could she say that did not reflect badly on herself? She had insulted a man who had done nothing but treat her kindly. He had sought out her company when no one else wished for it, and she had rewarded him with a most odious dismissal. She was ashamed of herself. Why had she capitulated so quickly to Charlotte Lucas's warnings? Why had she retreated so tamely when threatened with her mother's disapproval? It was not as though that was an unfamiliar experience. She was sure neither Elizabeth nor Lydia would have been so easily cowed, whereas she, Mary shook her head, contemptuous at her own weakness. In the days that followed, there was not a moment when she was not tormented by guilt or ferociously angry with herself. On the third night after the ball, once she had prepared herself for bed, she pulled up a chair to the bedroom window, opened it, and stared out into the dark, silent garden. Was this who she was? A coward who lacked the courage to follow her own inclinations. A silly girl, too timid to trust her own judgment, who submitted dumbly to what others told her. She breathed in the cool night air and hugged her shawl more tightly around her. That was not how she had felt when John Sparrow asked her to dance. Then she had been fearless, had she not? Then she had known her own mind. She bit her lip, forcing herself to think more clearly. In truth, she was compelled to admit that her mind had played no part at all in what had happened. When he invited her that second time, when he held out his hand to lead her to the dance floor, she had not consulted her intellect, of which she was so proud. She had weighed nothing up. She had not debated whether she should say yes or no. She had not considered how it would look or what her mother might say. She had not thought at all. She had been governed entirely by her feelings, by the pleasure she felt as he asked, and the excitement that mounted in her as she followed him into the crowd. Whilst it lasted, it had been wonderful. A shiver of delight ran through her as she remembered how she had felt as he smiled at her. But then Charlotte had spoken, and she had given in, and the result had been humiliation for both of them. For herself, she thought she could bear it, but it was inexpressibly painful to think she had inflicted hurt upon John Sparrow, whose only sin was to have been attentive to her. She rose and paced about her bedroom. Such a dreadful thing must never be allowed to happen again. It was all her fault. Her emotions had betrayed her. Her stupid, unruly feelings had led her into error, causing misery to a man who did not deserve it. They could not be trusted and must be tamed, subdued. She must find some other guide upon which to depend. She sat down at her desk, and her eye fell upon the many volumes piled up there. She ran her hand gently across their spines, and as she did so, an idea struck her. A thought so obvious, she could not believe it had not occurred to her before. Her books would save her. Within their pages, she would find everything she needed to keep her safe from further error. Writers whose capacities far exceeded her own would tell her how to behave. Their conclusions would direct her, show her what she must do to act rightly. In an instant, she understood that the books she devoured so avidly were not merely intellectual abstractions. A thoughtful reader like herself might treat them as handbooks, as manuals of instruction, from which rules might be extracted that explained how to live a calm and rational existence. Mary was alert now, her thoughts racing. Yes, yes, that made sense. Study would show her the way, if she allowed it to do so. The wisdom of the ages was surely more to be relied upon than her own ridiculous sentiments. But if she was to absorb and understand what she read, her mind must be clear and receptive, unclouded by strong emotions. If she wished to act rightly, she must conquer her passions. Her heart had failed her, and now her intellect must take its place. Her reason, and not her feelings, must in future be relied upon to tell her what to do. She must think more and feel less, That way she should do no more damage, either to herself or others. She moved back to her place by the window. Low voices rose up from the kitchen as Mrs. Hill and the servants cleared the last of the supper things. Mary closed her eyes and sat quite still, willing herself to accept the decision she had made. But for all her efforts, a wave of resentment rose up, unbidden, from within her, protesting at the course she meant to adopt. Did she appreciate what she was about to renounce? Was she really prepared never again to experience that glorious rush of excitement that had overwhelmed her when she had danced with John Sparrow? Never again to feel so exuberantly, unthinkingly immersed in the pleasure of the moment? As she recalled that fleeting happiness, part of her flinched at the severity of the measures she had imposed upon herself. But then she thought of John Sparrow's face, as he had looked when she rejected him. His remembered expression cut her to the quick. No, she had made her choice. She closed the window and made her way over to her bed. She would begin upon it the very next day. She lay there, eyes open, staring at the ceiling. There was nothing to be gained by delay. Chapter 13. The next morning, once breakfast was over, Mary made her way to the library. She was glad to find Mr. Bennet was not there. It would be easier to search for what she wanted without his sceptical eye upon her. She passed over the volumes of philosophy and history which usually detained her, consigning Locke, Hobbes, and Rousseau to some future period. She had decided to begin with more practical and direct works of instruction. It took a while before she found them, but eventually, tucked into a corner, she discovered a collection of little books whose titles suggested they were exactly what she sought. She picked up A Letter of Genteel and Moral Advice to a Young Lady and An Inquiry into the Duties of the Female Sex, and laid them on the table where she usually read and worked. Both were very dusty. It was a long time since anyone had taken them from their shelf. She took out her handkerchief, wiped off the worst of the dirt, and smiled as she imagined what Lydia would say if presented with them. But what was that to her? They might not please her sister, but they would do very well for her purposes. She added a few more similar works to her pile and took them away to examine them in private. Most did not detain her for long. Even in her present low-spirited state, Mary was not much enamoured of writers who insisted that a woman unfortunate enough to be in possession of any learning had better do all she could to conceal it. That savoured too much of her mother's opinion to please her. Perhaps, wondered Mary, it was Mrs. Bennet who had acquired the books in the first place. That thought did nothing further to recommend them, and she began to feel impatient with her haul. Finally, just as she was about to give up, she came upon a small book of sermons. Mary had never heard of its author, a Dr. Fordyce, but as she turned its pages, she quickly discovered that his ideas were far more to her taste. Unlike his fellow authors, he thought it a sad thing for a woman to remain in ignorance, her intellect neglected and unformed. For him, an inclination towards serious reading was an excellent quality in a female, a habit to be cultivated rather than concealed. It was much to be regretted, he added, that so many ladies read only novels. Such works could not add to the stock of their knowledge and offered instead a false and misleading picture of the world. Mary paused at this. Mrs. Bennet was a great reader of novels. Dr. Fordyce made some excellent points. She decided she would read on. As she did so, she discovered that Dr. Fordyce took a dim view of many of her mother's ruling passions. In his opinion, the hours spent on female fripperies such as dress, hair, and other adornments was time thrown away. These were empty distractions with which no sensible woman should concern herself. True beauty, he declared, had nothing to do with outward appearance. It came from within, the product of a well-regulated mind and a properly formed understanding. These qualities, and not a pretty face, are the real measure of a woman's worth. Mary took her pencil and carefully underlined this sentence. It was so much the opposite of everything her mother believed that it could not help but please her. However, continued Dr. Fordyce, it was regrettably the case that for some foolish people, good looks remained the only standard by which a woman is judged. But those of more discernment understand that a steady, informed character is a prize of incalculably more value. Theirs is the only good opinion worth having. Those who value more superficial qualities need not be attended to. The woman who grasps this important point will not bother herself with the pursuit of the empty trappings of fashion. She will use her time more sensibly, seeking to absorb any knowledge that will help her make the correct choices in her journey through life. Mary closed the book, elated. She had found what she wanted. In Dr. Fordyce's words, she heard Mrs. Bennet's vision of the world entirely rejected, whilst her own passions were thoroughly and completely vindicated. For the first time since the ball, her despondency lifted a little. Through her bedroom window, the garden sparkled with the first frost of winter. A pale sun shone in a sharp blue sky. Mary saw none of this, indifferent to everything but her new sense of purpose. She pulled a sheet of paper from her drawer and began to transcribe those passages from Dr. Fordyce which she had found particularly satisfying. She had been right to think that study was the answer. Study, hard work, and Dr. Fordyce would keep her from going wrong again. For weeks, Mary worked tirelessly in the library, making notes on everything she read, covering page after page in her neat handwriting. Once she had exhausted Dr. Fordyce, she moved on to other writers of whom he approved, and from them she was handed on, via footnote and reference, to yet more of similar inclination. There was rarely anyone in the library except herself and her father, but he never inquired what she was doing. His indifference was nothing new, but now that she felt herself embarked on something of real importance, it began to provoke her. She longed to know what he would think of the task she had set herself. He was a reading man, the only Bennet, besides herself, with an appetite for scholarly works. If anyone was to understand the urgency of her desire to find a rational way to live, surely it would be him. She put down her pen and stared into the still library air, imagining how it would be if that were to happen. She saw herself explaining her plans to him, calmly and steadily, with none of the flustered self-consciousness that usually afflicted her in his presence. He listened, neither mocking nor belittling her, and as she spoke, she grew gradually more confident, blooming in the warmth of his approval. A bridge had been crossed, a bond formed between them. They had become partners in a shared endeavour. From then on, the library was no longer silent, but was full of lively conversation as father and daughter shared their ideas. Mr. Bennet asked for her opinions of writers she had read, and suggested names of those she had not. Slowly but steadily, Mary was invited not only into the private world of her father's intellectual domain, but also into his affections, both of them places where, until now, only Lizzie had been admitted. Far away in the depths of the house, a door slammed, a servant called out, and Mary was shaken abruptly from her daydream. Back in the real world, her father's expression as he turned a page of his book was as sardonic as ever, and just as unreachable. Only in her dream would Mary have the courage to approach him directly. Attempting it here, in the library, face to face, no, she could not do it. She would not know how to begin. She saw herself retreating in confusion under the power of his merciless smile. And yet, she could not resign herself to giving up. The dream in which he became her intellectual confidant was too seductive to abandon. If she could not trust herself to speak to her father, she must find some other way of making her ambitions known to him. The answer finally occurred to her one morning as she walked into Meryton. She had not wanted to leave the library, but Mrs. Hill had harried her until she agreed to put on her coat and go out into the fresh air. She went alone, dawdling along the quiet lanes, her thoughts directionless. It was not until she was at the outskirts of the village that she was struck by a thought that was both exciting and terrible. What if she were to see John Sparrow there? She stopped and stood motionless among the nettles, considering. If their paths crossed,
If he saw her, perhaps he would ask how she did. She would reply. He would speak again, and somehow, perhaps she might get out an apology, an explanation for what had happened. And then he would... Oh, but no, she told herself, this was foolish. This was precisely the kind of silliness in which she had resolved not to indulge. It would not do. If they were to meet, all she could expect was a curt raising of his hat as he walked on. He would not stop to talk. Her eyes filled with tears. Perhaps she should turn back. But that would prove she was even more faint-hearted than she had already shown herself to be. She wiped her face and pulled up her collar against the cold. She would go into Meryton, but not for one moment whilst she was there would she allow herself to think of John Sparrow. She walked bravely down the single street, looking neither to the left nor the right. But when she came to its end, she had no further idea what she was to do there, for she had left Longbourn without any object in mind beyond her arrival. She supposed she might look at the shops. That was what her sisters would do. But the haberdashers where Kitty and Lydia spent their allowances was of no interest to her. Instead, she headed to the stationer's. Staring through the shop window, she looked longingly at the thick cream paper, fine sharp pencils, and perfumed sealing waxes. Beautiful writing things always made her mouth water, and these were particularly attractive. How satisfying it would be to have some useful occupation on hand for which they could be used. They would be the perfect materials to use in composing a little book, for example. The different coloured inks could be used very prettily to illustrate favourite sayings. As she regarded them hungrily, it occurred to her that such a book would be the perfect gift for her father, demonstrating to him not only the strength of her affection, but also the extent of her reading. She could choose extracts from her favourite authors, copying them onto its pages and presenting them in a way that was sure to intrigue and impress him. It would say what she could not, displaying the range and depth of her interests. Her work was sure to be a better advocate for her ambitions than anything she could say to him. She grew more and more excited as she thought about it. The intellectual challenge, deciding which passages to include, came first, of course. But there would be a great deal of pleasure in making the little book as pleasing to the eye as it would be to the mind. She would buy the best book she could afford, with a soft leather cover and good quality paper for its blank pages. She would need a new set of pens, some coloured inks, and perhaps an ebony ruler. She had always wanted one of those. Her manner was positively jaunty as she entered the stationer's shop to make her purchases, and her cheerfulness lasted all the way home, as she began to plan how the title page might look. It was only when she sat down at her desk that she realised she had left Meryton with no sighting at all of John Sparrow. She felt a sharp pang of regret, but before it could take hold, she stiffened her resolve. She opened the new book, took out her ruler, gathered her pens together, and began to write.